From a fallout shelter in the Texas Observer, it is the Texas Observer podcast. This is our second episode, and I have with me two fantastic gentlemen. To my left is Patrick Michaels, staff writer at the Observer. Patrick, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you, Jonathan?
I'm doing very, very well. Also with us is Alex Hannaford, a freelance writer for the Texas Observer. Alex, how are you?
Good, thanks for having me.
Excellent. And I am Jonathan McNamara, the web editor for the Texas Observer. Anyway, a couple things to talk about today. We'll be talking about Alex Hannaford's Heritage of Abuse piece, which was originally published online and later used for the March edition of the Texas Observer. We'll also get the scoop on South by Southwest EDU, courtesy of Patrick. So, Alex, let's start with you. Can you reacquaint us a little bit with sort of the gist of the Heritage of Abuse piece?
Yeah, so... First of all, this is a community, religious community, with a strong sort of kind of Pentecostal background, and they sort of live essentially like the Amish now in Waco, in a place about 7 miles outside of Waco. And I'd read online some stuff. There's a lot of sort of discussion forums and stuff going on online, and there's a lot of discussion about between former members of this church about abuse they claimed they had suffered when they were members of the church, mental abuse and all sorts. And so I was interested. There was a story in the Waco Herald Tribune that appeared a few years ago, kind of about sort of alleging mind control and stuff. And so I was interested in finding out more.
So let me just stop you for a second. When you say mind control, what exactly are you talking about?
So former members claim that the way in which the leadership of the church is structured, and the way in which they berate them in front of the congregation amounts to mind control. And that's not just a case of just them, you know, someone being in church and being told, no, it's not like that, or you know, made to look stupid. What they were telling me is that it's something that happens over a long period of time. So there's a big body of work that suggests that mind control works. One of the kind of tactics of employing mind control is by love bombing someone, and then the next time, basically knocking the confidence out of them completely and making them look stupid in front of the whole congregation. And this kind of goes on and on and on, and eventually they become beholden to whoever it is doing the controlling. And former members say this is the tactic that's employed by the leadership at Homestead Heritage.
And what kind of environment has that created at Homestead Heritage?
Former members say that it's created a sort of environment of fear, you know, some of these people have left, and it's taken them a long time to kind of rebuild their lives. And so I talked to a lot of former members, and they are now sort of feeling that they want to stop this happening to other people that are in there. And I think that, you know, certainly with this story, it kind of talks about a lot of different facets of what was going on. But I think certainly the public at large would be more concerned about the fact that there are kids in there and what's happening to the kids. And, you know, do they actually have a choice? Homestead Heritage would say, well, you know, they're away from all the evils of the outside world and all the rest of it, and we kind of protect them and stuff. But, you know, former members say, well, they don't really have a choice. This is kind of, they're being told what to think and all the rest of it.
Now, when your post, when your feature originally went up on the website, there was a lot of comment reaction to that. Can you describe some of that briefly?
Yeah, so a lot of people had said to me, you should be prepared for these guys to kind of hit back in a big way. And Homestead Heritage, while I was, you know, I asked them for an interview a few times, and I was turned down. You know, I mean, I wanted to go up there to Waco and sit down with them and go through all these accusations with them and give them a chance to respond. And they didn't want to do that. And so before the piece was even published, they'd created this web page within their website, and the URL is something like homesteadheritage.com/slander, and nothing was on there. I mean, it hadn't kind of gone live by the time we went to press, and then a few days after we went to press, suddenly content started appearing. And there was some text on there, first of all, and then they produced a video. And all the while, there's also comments going on in our own, on the Texas Observer website. I mean, now it even brought the website down at some point because of the volume of people that were kind of going onto there and commenting. And these were people that I'd interviewed. These were other former members that were kind of agreeing with them about what they were saying about the church. And there were also people that were saying, no, you've got it wrong. This is not what my experience was in the church at all. And so I was prepared for that. I guess I was surprised at the lengths the church has gone to on their own website. They've produced a fairly slick video, and now they've rebutted the story in a sort of point by point, you know, way. And it's reams and reams. It's taken someone a really long time to do it. A couple of points I want to make about that. I'm not going to get into the he said, she said thing, but a couple points I'd like to make. One is that, you know, I did ask for an interview with the church several times, and right. was turned down. I actually asked for an interview with the leader of the church, Blair Adams, the founder, mm-hmm. and I was told he was too sick to talk to me, yet he appears on their video, and he looks fairly sprightly.
And their line about why they didn't grant an interview was because they had an idea of what was coming and they didn't want to dignify it with...
Right. They said, we've heard these allegations before and we don't want to dignify it with a response. My problem with that, not really a problem, I just kind of feel that as a journalist, you know, you want to write a piece that puts both sides. You know, do I think my story that appeared in The Observer put both sides? Well, no, it couldn't do because they refused to talk to me. So, you know, and I think that's a shame, actually, because I think that they've used their own website to do that, but I don't think they've got really the same platform as the Observer. And they could have done, you know, they could have done both. They could have given me an interview. They could have given me their side of the story. They could have rebutted whatever allegations they wanted to. And then they could still have done the video and their full point-by-point rebuttal. And I feel that was a shame, actually. The other thing I wanted to mention is that they seem very aggrieved that one of their biggest criticisms was that I didn't go to them in the beginning, that I'd been working on this story for 2 months and didn't go to them for a response right in the beginning. And frankly, that's ludicrous. And it just shows a misunderstanding of how journalism works, because in the beginning, I didn't have a story. In the beginning, I'd read some stuff online. I couldn't substantiate any of it. And it took me 2 months of interviewing people and you know, going up to Waco and sitting down with people. This person, Sandy, that I interviewed, you know, it may only amount to a couple of paragraphs in the story, but I interviewed her for about an hour and a half or 2 hours. And her story is absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, here is a girl who is saying she was sexually abused as a child by two adults in the church. And instead of going to the police, an elder in the church instead disfellowshipped the men and got her to basically admit responsibility or part responsibility for what happened. And she's frightened. She's frightened. She wants to heal. You know, I have told her that she needs to go to the police and Child Protective Services because these people could still be doing it. She knows who this elder is in the church that knew about it, and he knows who he is as well. And he had a responsibility to go to the police and Child Protective Services and didn't. And, you know, since this story has come out, also, you know, back on the thing about they wanted me to go to them in the beginning. You know, the story developed over 2 months, and, you know, it would have been ridiculous for me to go to them in the beginning and say, I've read some stuff online. Can you comment? You know, I started realizing there was a story after a week or so, built this story up. And then I wanted to go to them with what I had. And so I had a full, you know, a full kind of body of evidence to go to them and say, look, this is what I found out. What's your take on this?
All right. Speaking of that video, let's take a minute here and take a look at it. Alex, can you introduce some of the characters that we're going to be seeing in this promotion video from Homestead Heritage?
Yeah, they did this video rebuttal to the story, and you're going to see, Blair Adams, who's the founder of the church, Abraham Adams, who is his son, who former members say is kind of being lined up to take over from Blair Adams, and Amanda Lancaster, who's Blair's daughter. So I think the majority of the people in their video are related to Blair Adams in some way.
Why are ex-members so bitter towards you? Why are they saying these things if they're not true? And it's a very good question. It's a legitimate question. And the answer is that many of them are not. Many ex-members are not bitter toward us. Many of them are still our friends. The question is about these who are voicing these kind of false accusations against us.
In one way, it's not hard to imagine how these stories generate, because, you know, I've seen it before in people. When you've experienced something wonderful and you decide you can't do it, you can't live up to the standard, then you walk away from it, you've lost it, and somehow you've got to justify what you've done.
And that's their right, and it's their choice. But sometimes they can be embittered, just as in a divorce where people have been so close and shared so much, it's become a syndrome that the spouses will end up incredibly hostile.
All right, Alex, what do you think about that video?
I think it's very slickly produced.
I mean, you can tell how deeply the folks in the church care too, looking at it. I mean, the responses are very personal.
They are, and I think that the problem I've got is that, you know, it has to be taken as a whole. You've got the video response. You've also got the printed response, where they actually go into. I don't think they left anyone out. Actually, they literally take every person that I named that I interviewed in the thing, and essentially pull them apart. And I think my problem with that, and also if you look at the comments section of the Observer website, which I recommend everyone goes to.
328 comments right. as of this
At
recording
least.
Right now.
Maybe more.
It's going to take a while to get through. But the thing is, you know, you've got a lot of former members kind of commenting in that as well, either agreeing with the story that I produced, but also saying, oh, well, you didn't talk to me and I had no problem when I was in the church. And I've got two things to say to that, I think. One is that, you know, there's a lot of people that are commenting that have got parents still in the church, or leaders, parents that are leaders of the church. And also, I wanted to say, yeah, I think that if you take everything as a whole, the video response and the text response and the comments as the whole sort of response to the story, I think the problem is that they've tried to sort of assassinate the characters of the people I've spoken to. Problem I have with that is these people, it took them a lot of courage to speak about what happened to them. These are their personal stories. And I think the problem with pulling those apart are that, you know, they're saying this is what happened to them. They're not saying that this other person that happens to have had a great time at Homestead Heritage and has come out and got no problems with it. You know, they're not saying that, they're not disbelieving them. No one's disbelieving them. But at the same time, you know, that doesn't negate the fact that some bad stuff has happened to some people there. And the church seems to not want to acknowledge that.
If you watch the video from the beginning, they start off by relying a lot on sort of the goodwill that they've tried to foster in the community, I think, and having kids in for field trips and things like that, as if that's somehow a response to these specific allegations that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's almost sort of setting up a straw man. It's like saying if I was doing a story, I don't know, on like murder in Detroit. Someone saying, well, it was a really bad piece because you just focused on the murder. Why didn't you do something on my brilliant tennis club that I belong to? I mean, there are, you know, of course there are some good things about the community. I don't think anyone, even ex-members that are disgruntled, would say that it's all bad. I mean, you know, there are certainly things in the community that are very good. You know, the food in the cafe, for example. Well, the other thing I kind of wanted to mention was that this concept of ex-members is very strange to me. You know, you very rarely hear of ex-members of a church, and you even get on the video the church that Blair Adams himself talking about ex-members. Well, that's very odd. Why would you have an ex-member of? Why would you have a member of a church that's left that calls themselves an ex-member? It's sort of a loaded term. It's kind of got a lot of there's a lot of questions I think you have with the term ex-member. You know, if I belong to a church and I just left because I moved out of state, or I moved, you know, maybe my partner didn't want to, was of a different denomination. That's why you would leave. You wouldn't normally leave a church otherwise. I mean, that's kind of, unless you just weren't religious anymore. It's kind of an odd concept. And Blair Adams likens this thing to a divorce. And he says, sometimes they can be bitter, hostile and hateful. How odd that a member of a church would leave and then become bitter, hateful and hostile towards it.
I mean, it probably also speaks to the intensity of the experience of belonging to the church and just how much of yourself you have to give up as a member. Mm-hmm. You know, when you break, that break becomes that much stronger too.
Mm. Yeah, but I feel that even the ex-members that I've spoken to are not hostile because of, they're certainly not saying that they objected to the hard work that they had to do or giving themselves over to the church. It's the what they say was kind of mental abuse in the church. That's what they have the problem with. I don't think any of them really objected to the, and that's why they joined the church in the first place, because of the lifestyle and, you know, having a closer relationship with God.
Well, Alex, thanks for coming by and filling us in on what's been going on with the story since it went live. You can see that story on TexasObserver.org. You can also read it in the March issue. From there, we'll be talking with with Patrick Michaels.
Little change of pace.
Not quite as dreary a subject. We'll be talking about South by Southwest EDU. I understand.
I mean, it had its low points. It had its highs and its lows.
What, like there was?
I wouldn't call it dreary.
A lack of good coffee. That kind of low.
The coffee was not free. That was a big downside for me. But you know.
But you spent most of the week at South by Southwest EDU. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. So it was the first of the South by Southwest events happening in the next week or so here in Austin. It's one of the youngest of the family of events. It was about 3 days at the Hilton downtown. And it drew sort of a few heavy hitter speakers. There was U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan was there. Marjorie Scardino, the chief executive officer of Pearson, the big London-based school textbook publisher,
largest book publisher in the world.
Penguin,
I understand.
They publish everything probably that you've got. And LeVar Burton, who we all remember fondly from Reading Rainbow and Star Trek TNG.
What is EDU South by Southwest?
Okay, yeah, so it's the idea is that it's for sort of burgeoning education startups. It's a spinoff in a way from South by Southwest Interactive, and it's a lot of sort of the same mindset where you'll come in there, you're with the next big Twitter or Foursquare, but it's only for things that are based in schools.
Mm.
So it's a lot of games. There are people who develop games to teach statistics or networking platforms for teachers so that they're connected across schools and can share questions.
Right.
Evaluation tools for principals to use for teachers. And it's sort of this mindset that, you know, technology is helping us so much in all of our lives. But specifically in schools, it's sort of an untapped market. And so, you know, how folks who are working to bring new technology into schools and improve our education system. That's sort of what that's about. So one of the things that I thought was interesting about South by Southwest EDU was the sort of the kind of conversation it was. It was very similar to the interactive crowd, where everyone has their latest social media tool that they want to try out. There were folks from the Gates Foundation there talking about their sort of mindset when they're looking at projects to fund. And one of the ones that they sort of one of their rules they fall back on is don't be afraid to fail. And that's like straight out of the Silicon Valley mindset. You know, and there are a lot of these folks who with these tech startups who are trying to do a good thing and want to put their time and energy into a worthy cause. And so they go to education. But there wasn't a lot of discussion of sort of the downside to that attitude, that you have like a limited amount of time with kids in classrooms. And if you're testing out something in a first grade classroom that just doesn't work. And you have to pilot it somewhere. But if you test it out in that first grade classroom, those kids don't get that year back, and so there's a really serious cost to that. And there was the comparison that someone drew during the conference was to looking at testing out medicines, and you need to just the idea that you need to be really careful about how you test things out as you adopt them. So there was a lot of sort of gung-ho pro technology attitudes.
So there wasn't a whole lot of talk about the inherent risk factors when you're introducing like a new piece of technology or a new learning tool and you don't know whether or not it's going to work. I mean, the obvious example that comes to my mind, of course, is laser discs, which ultimately resulted in a lot of wasted money and perhaps some equally wasted time. Were there some specific examples from the conference of like new tools, new educational tools that you saw that you think, you know, might not be worth the risk?
Well, I think, I mean, like broadly speaking, there were a lot of games that people had to teach statistics classes or writing tools, things like that, that, you know, might be more efficient ways of doing some kind of teaching. But a lot of the games that were on display, you know, I mean, they came from this place that was like, anything that looks like teaching is going to be bad, because we know how much kids hate sitting in class and learning things, so that you want to fool them into thinking that they're just playing a game.
Right, so you put zombies and shotguns in it.
Right. Well, you don't do that. You can't have guns in school, Jonathan.
Oh, right. My bad.
Presumably there's less problem with it being a piece of software that, you know, could become obsolete and doesn't really matter because it's only, you know, okay, so what? But if it's a piece of hardware and it doesn't, people don't adapt to it or doesn't take off, then they've wasted all this money and training and all the rest of it. That can be a bit of an issue, I suppose.
I mean, you're getting at the big player there was the iPad, you know, in all the classrooms now. You know, there are a few panels on how to use the iPads in class. There was like a case study from Westlake High School just around Austin, where they had just rolled out their one-to-one iPad to student program. And they talked about how, you know, lessons they'd learned in the first year of doing it. And they answered a lot of sort of the practical questions that we've been talking about around the office, too. Of, you know, what does this stuff look like? But it's expensive, you know.
It's expensive, yeah, and expensive for something that will become obsolete after a couple of years.
But wait a minute. Textbooks are just $15 on the iPad, right? I mean, you know, we've seen the keynote. We know it's what Apple's saying. It's $15 a textbook. I mean, where's the inherent price in this?
Well, you gotta buy the iPad too.
Oh yeah, I guess that's a good point.
Right.
Speaking of the iPad, there's an Apple trailer video for textbooks on the iPad where some teachers had this to say about outmoded educational tools.
I teach because when you learn, you become a better person. Always.
I get to see young minds blossom, grow, develop.
The ability to engage a student is the key to being a good teacher.
Using outdated materials such as textbooks makes that job much more difficult.
In textbooks, you know, there's diagrams, but they're static. Something like a cell membrane is a fluid thing. It's always moving.
With U.S. history, they print a textbook and it's outdated almost the second that it's printed.
Textbooks are very expensive. They're usually $60 to $100 for different textbooks. So they're adopted for 5 years and then you're stuck with them.
They're extremely heavy, and if you have three or four in a backpack, you know, it's a lot of weight, and so some students will simply just quit bringing textbooks to class.
So here's the thing. Textbooks on the iPad, just like books on the iPad, it's all very well, and I have books on my iPad. When you're lying in bed and you're lying there with the iPad above your head reading a book and flicking through the pages, it's awfully heavy.
That's true. It's dangerous if you're not careful.
You fall asleep and it lands on your face. It's done that a few times to me.
Well, you know, it's interesting you point that out, because one of the great selling points of textbooks on the iPad, this is my personal favorite selling point, is that textbooks are just too heavy. They're too heavy to carry around in books. Every preview that I've seen for textbooks on the iPad so far has mentioned this. And I got to say, I carried around textbooks in school. Patrick?
I definitely did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't read them, but I carried them.
What you're saying is that kids these days are getting soft. And you know, yeah. Back in your day, it was a lot tougher.
Yeah, when we just had static text, no animation, mm-hmm. had to carry things around. It was great.
Those were the days, Jonathan.
Those were the golden days of learning.
So I talked to one guy at the conference who has a blog on the business of education, and he was just there as a participant. He has his own company, but one of his posts on his blog was about how the actual cost of an iPad program in schools is not as insignificant as Apple likes to talk about, and that we can link to it on our blog. But the headline of his post is Apple's iPad textbooks cost 5 times more than print. And you know what he breaks down the numbers that, you know, if a school district is buying a bunch of books and then using them year after year for kids, then that actually, you know, makes it less expensive than buying a new iPad and then buying that same book, you know, every year. That's $15 per kid every year after you've bought the iPad as
like
well.
Like a licensing agreement,
right? So there are things like that that they're working out with certain school districts, but exactly what it costs is still sort of up in the air, and that's one of those things that you only see after a few years of this. How many iPads get stolen, how many break, how well do they hold up after a few years at, running the latest textbooks.
It sounds like this is all very good for Apple, but I mean, the thing is that they didn't some company a few years ago make these $100 laptops for African school kids,
or was called the Exo laptop,
in certain countries in Africa. Yeah, and maybe they could make a very, very cheap tablet which just runs sort of these kind of textbook reading software or something. I don't know.
Well, I think we should point out, as Patrick has pointed out already, there are a lot of details about this that we don't know. One of the things we don't know is if Apple is subsidizing this for schools at all. I haven't seen anything about that. Have you?
They should.
I mean, that's a good question. Is how much do they drive their prices down in bulk? Districts have their purchasers that work with them on those things.
Brad, I know that at the college level, Apple discounts their products to a certain degree for students.
I mean, not to get too wonky on this, but one of the things that I'm working on for next week that we'll see is some of these school districts are using they're issuing bonds to pay for iPad programs. Other ones are using federal money to pay for them. Another ones are just pulling out of their operation funds to pay for iPads. So there are a lot of different ways that districts are finding the money to do this. But when they buy all the iPads for their students, they also realize pretty quickly they need to beef up their infrastructure too, and they need to get stronger Wi-Fi for the whole school, and other costs that go along with kind of rolling out a robust program all at once. But Apple wasn't one of the sponsors of this conference, which is pretty interesting. I mean, they were just kind of there wherever you looked. But Pearson was the company that you saw everywhere. That the name tags said Pearson on the lanyard. They had reps talking in a few different panels. And their chief executive, Marjorie Scardino, gave one of the keynote addresses in the speech. And if you want to check out Pearson's influence in Texas, Abby Rappaport had a great story on them last September we can link to, too.
Yeah, I'll be linking to that in the podcast or the blog post for the show.
And they're the ones that have the $500 million contract for testing in Texas. A lot of the schools in the state buy their textbooks from them. What Scardino said is that they're looking at a place where textbooks are a much smaller part of what they do, and that little digital tools are really going to be where their business is, like games, smaller pieces like that. And so for a lot of companies that were at this conference, you could tell that they were treating it as sort of an audition session, the way that you might bring your film to Sundance to try and get it discovered and get it released. You're trying to get your startup picked up by one of the big fishes there.
So actually this week on the Observer quiz on Facebook, we asked if our readers thought that iPads in schools were a good idea or perhaps a bad idea, and to explain why. And we got a couple of responses that I'm going to read through at least a little bit. Maybe we can react to that. Leigh Newsom says that iPads are overwhelmingly a good idea, that they contribute significant savings on the cost of textbooks, that digital versions can literally save entire forests of trees and dramatically reduce air and water pollutants released by paper mills. iPads can also be used to incorporate instruction in disciplines that a school district may not otherwise be able to afford. For instance, art programs, which have suffered greatly in public schools as funding levels have been cut. So there's a lot here. Overwhelmingly good stuff. What do you think?
Don't they have some precious metal in that's really difficult to come
I was going to say, they don't actually grow on trees. I mean, they have a footprint of their own, and there's the issue of how much people are paid to make them.
Right,
a good point about the amount of books you can get on.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely a lot of possibilities, and they're a tool that a lot of people are using as a great platform. LeVar Burton was there in his keynote. He announced that Reading Rainbow is coming back in a month or two, and it's going to be as an app. They're going to have celebrities reading books, and you'll have it all right there, as your app.
We didn't have that in England growing up. I don't even know what you're talking about.
We'll fill you in. We'll fill you in later. It's a great show. I'm getting the app. That's as simple as that gets.
Ours was called Jack and Ori. If it's the same thing, ours was Jack and Ori.
Jack and Ori?
That's, it's like, hey, kids, reading's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But don't take my word for it.
See, and that's how he, that's actually how he ended his talk. He didn't sing the song, but he did give the peace out.
Good for him. Layla Sham says, I guess it remains to be seen how responsible children can take care of the iPads. If they can manage not to lose or break them, I can't see how this wouldn't be a perfect solution.
Westlake High School, after their year-long pilot of this thing, I guess it's only been a semester that they've actually had it roll out, but they had five lost iPads, lost or stolen, and three of them were returned. Those are the statistics that they had, so not bad. But you have to look at that also. This is one of the, you know, wealthy enclaves around Austin. One of the iPads was found in the produce section of Whole Foods.
Nice.
So this wasn't, you know, ripped out of a kid's backpack at the bus stop.
Right, right. There are a couple other school districts around the state that are beginning to institute or have already instituted this program. I know one of them is McAllen. They have something like 6,000, I believe, devices, iPads and iPod touches being released to students. And then there's also New Braunfels, which has rolled out an iPad program, but they're giving iPads to freshmen.
I mean, a lot of the districts are catching flack for spending, you know, $20 million bucks on these programs.
This is what I was going to try and work that out. That's like a lot of money, right?
At a time when, you know, I think Fort Bend is one of these that's been kind of a favorite whipping boy of Michael Quinn Sullivan and Empower Texans, and they're talking about how you're suing the state over insufficient funding for right. schools, and you're turning around and you're...
On teachers being, like, laid off.
Right. Right. So you're, one of the issues is that it's separate money streams, so that you know, you'd pay teachers out of one pot of money, mm-hmm. and the iPad buying pot is coming from somewhere else. So you know, it's not sort of a either or sort of arrangement.
A bit of a slap in the face, though, for teachers that have been laid off.
Mm-hmm. You know, and they Arnie Duncan's take on that at this conference was that, you know, he pointed out a district in North Carolina that's had a pretty successful one-to-one laptop program. And when it, you know, his idea is that it's an investment in the future, that it's a large expenditure right away, and the returns are much greater in the long run.
Interestingly enough, Crystal Simmons on our Facebook page said, "Why must they be iPads? I'm sure school districts can substitute cheaper tablets or e-readers with the same benefits. Students don't need top-notch devices on which to read textbooks, which seems to be the main benefit." I don't know about that. I mean, technologically speaking, the iPad is a pretty far cry from, say, like the Nook or the Kindle.
She's got a point, though, if it's just to read textbooks. I mean, unless we are talking about interactive things and video and all the rest of it, but I mean, if it's just textbooks.
Well, right. Well, one of the big selling points that Apple points out is that they do have, like, animation, like schematics that aren't static, you know, illustrations that aren't static. They actually move and you can interact with them to a certain degree. I'm not sure if those other devices can handle that. I certainly haven't heard of that.
So I can go back to the panel I heard from the folks at Westlake High School. And they looked at a few different devices. They mentioned that KDISD outside Houston had implemented an Android tablet program before them, or at least maybe since then. But they decided the iPad was the way to go, not even because of the textbooks that were on there, which, you know, kind of came out with such great hullabaloo, but it was the apps that were on there. So not, you know, beyond the content, it was, you know, things that they could use to teach statistics more effectively and even manage things for teachers. And there were enough apps on there already that they liked to use. They decided that was the way to go.
Right on. Well, we had one more comment on the Facebook page.
The most exciting comment of all.
Pretty much
in this segment.
Most exciting. From Philip W. Peoples, who is the drummer from the old 97s.
Which I had to tell Jonathan.
I didn't know.
I couldn't believe it. I saw that name and I was like, wow.
I proposed
to my wife to that song, the old 97s song, I can't remember what it's called now. Mm-hmm. It was a really magical moment.
we're gonna record you saying that later when you actually remember the name of the song.
You're talking about Question.
Question,
of course. Yeah,
of course.
Of course. Mr. Peoples said, unless they disable the ability to download apps or stream movies, this sounds like a colossal waste of public school resources. Unless, of course, you're on their board of education and are pocketing a sweet profit off the deal, I smell a skunk.
Strong words.
Very strong words. Well, I mean, he's a rock and roll drummer. Like,
he doesn't mince words.
No, he doesn't.
No, I mean, I think the issue with a lot of school districts buying into this really quickly. One of The guy from Westlake High School said one of the first things they did to try and get the district to buy in is they got the superintendent an iPad. You know, so once the boss has one of these cool things to play with, they're going to be quicker on board. So I don't know that anyone, you know, I haven't heard any stories of school board members with, you know, who are taking kickbacks from Apple or Pearson for these deals. But they do kind of.
I have.
they're easy sells. I mean, they look cool and they're a lot of fun. You know, and they have like really good PR folks talking them up too. They have a strong message.
One of the problems, right, presumably, is that if you've got an iPad, if you're a kid, 14 years old, 15 years old, you're in the classroom, you've got your iPad, you're supposed to be looking at this textbook. You can't easily just go and look at, you know, I don't know what the kids listen to these days, but whatever it is, and you could
play Angry Birds.
You could do, and
cut the rope.
When we were in school, you know, you got your textbook there.
Right.
You're not gonna like, you know, I mean, it's just Shakespeare, right? There's no like.
Ah, but you can hide a magazine in a textbook if it's big enough textbook.
Right.
You could.
I mean, you're talking about just different problems.
Yeah.
You know, any teacher has challenges with keeping folks in line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just find your workarounds. And mm-hmm. there was the stats teacher that was at the conference said that he gave tests. He designed them with bright purple backgrounds or bright green backgrounds. So he could just walk around the room and he could look to see, you know, which kids were doing something else. Mm-hmm. You know, who was messaging the other one the answers right away. And, you know, there are all kinds of, like, taking screen grabs of a test would be a problem, too, and you have to work around that. And so there are a lot of little tricks that he had to anticipate. But, you know, it's just like anything else in teaching. It's just a matter of adjusting and sort of getting smart about the technology before the kids do.
Certainly there are ways to block certain kinds of content on school-issued iPads. I mean, I can't imagine that we're going to have school districts that are basically giving, you know, at least high school age kids, right? You know, devices that can access the internet and don't have some sort of security protocols. I mean, that would be ludicrous, right?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'm sure there's the firewall at the school. If they're on Wi-Fi there, that's what they'll be using. But from the Westlake High School example, they gave these kids the iPads. They're going to take them to college with them when they go. And they can download whatever they want onto it. They can download movies onto it. I mean, it's their iPad. And so... You know, it's just like any other tool they want to give out. They sort of came at it with a mindset that this is something that they, you know, this is an expense for the school to have the kids use this thing, and it's up to the kids to use it responsibly.
All right, Patrick. Well, thanks for filling us in on South by Southwest EDU. You know, all that iPad talk kind of makes me wish I was a freshman in high school.
It's never too late to go back.
Well, maybe in this case.
Legally speaking, I think it is actually too late. You shouldn't do that.
Well, thanks for listening. This has been the Texas Observer podcast. You can find some links to some of the things we talked about in this episode in the blog post for this show, which will appear shortly on texasobserver.org. I'd like to thank our panelists for today, Alex Hannaford.
Thank you.
And Patrick Michaels.
It's been fun.
We'll see you guys in approximately 2 weeks, you know, if we can avoid using our iPads.